Welcome to Bodcast, the Business of Dentistry podcast, brought to you by Practice Plan. Bodcast delivers the best business advice, real-life stories, and practical hints and tips to make your practice a more profitable and sustainable business. And now, here's your host.
Hello, my name is Nigel Jones and I'm Sales and Marketing Director at Practice Plan, and I'd like to welcome you to today's edition of Bodcast, where we're going to be in conversation with David Houston. And David, perhaps you could introduce yourself for the listeners.
Thank you, Nigel. My name is David Houston, General Practitioner of a mixed practice in the North Somerset and Bristol area, where we perform both NHS and private dentistry to a large patient base.
Okay. Now, you have a number of associates that work as part of the organisation.
I have 34 associates.
Yeah, which must make you one of the biggest of your kind.
Probably true, yes.
And I think what I was really interested in is to understand a little bit more about your business model and how you manage and motivate that team of 34 clinicians that you've got working for you in what's an increasingly pressurised environment, it seems. Now, I realise that you might be able to help them manage that environment, but we're hearing all the time about the pressure of working on the NHS and the pressure of regulation, litigation matters. How do you tackle all those sorts of things with that large team of yours?
Well, if it's of interest to the audience, although I admit that ours is a very unique model, which they may aspire to but might not be able to achieve instantly, we work on a hub and spoke model. It's just that our hub is particularly large because it's a single site practice with 29 surgeries contained within the one set of buildings. That also includes a teaching facility, lecture theatres and two separate laboratories. So it is more like a hospital model, perhaps, than a general practice model. But it allows upselling and more advanced secondary care treatments to be carried out on the same site, therefore providing for a true continuity of care, because the patient pathway is quite literally in the same site, in the same buildings. However, we do have three spoke practices, which would be much more recognisable to the profession, because it follows a model of three to four surgeries run as general practices, and they seek secondary care and specialist services by referring back to the hub practice. And therefore, deliberately, our business model almost prevents us from buying too far away from our hub, because it must be commutable to make it work as a business development plan. So we look to go no further than about 19 to 20 miles from the hub as a working commutable distance. But that gives our associates a potential career pathway, because we do have an FD1 teaching commitment, so quite literally we can have a really qualified practitioner. And we would then go all the way to someone who has perhaps been loyal to us for the last 25 years and have a senior associate who hasn't worked anywhere else since the 1990s. So therefore, if they wish to stay with us, they could have a pathway marked out for them to progress from NHS to private to specialist, and never leave the umbrella of the organisation if that was attractive to them.
And it sounds like that would be the kind of thing that is attractive to people, because it's an increasingly complex world that newer dentists are entering.
And
it sounds like you provide quite a lot of support. So what sort of areas are you finding that you need to focus on with them?
Undoubtedly, compliance and the fear of litigation. So the undergraduates, with respect, are taught how to do dentistry, but very rarely are they taught how to do dentistry in the real world. So when they arrive and are faced with patients, they need mentoring, they need guidance, they need support. Obviously some more than others, depending on their inherent character. But during the FD 1 year, they are mentored one-on-one by their trainer, by definition. And usually, in many ways, that is the best year-long job interview you could ever hope for. So that if we get on well with an individual colleague and they have a desire for a career in general practice, we can often progress them into the organisation at the end of the year seamlessly, because they know no other way. They have been brought up, as it were, within our ethos. And it's a very easy transition from month 12 of FD1 to month 1 of associateship. But then, after some years, perhaps building up an NHS list or coping with an NHS commitment, and although I'm obviously going to say this speaking to you as your role as a director of practice plan, as you know, we use the model of conversion. So once that associate has established goodwill, a rapport, and a reputation, they can then use that to best advantage and create a private list to help their career development and job satisfaction in the private sector. And we as a business selfishly can reclaim their UDA commitment to pass on to the next FD1 who can be kept on and starting the loop from that model. And in that way, we are not as limited by our UDA targets as certain practices who hit an artificial ceiling, because once they're producing, they've got to their maximum.
So I was interested when you said about the fact that if you've had basically a year-long job interview, yes, when they were FD, what sort of things are you looking for then that will encourage you to keep them on as opposed to...
Attitude. Because you can teach someone skills, as well as assume they're willing to learn. But obviously you would not by definition keep on somebody who was not willing to learn. Mm. But if they showed, in the words of sort of, you know, the Tom Cruise, the right stuff, then you would always feel you could work with that person. They may be a late bloomer, they may be a slow developer, but if you saw that they were buying into the ethos of the group, they were a good team player, they were popular with both patients and staff, that's the sort of individual that you feel would bring value to us, and we could help and we want to help. So we're looking for the attitude, not necessarily the definitive outcome, because we realise it may be a little soon to judge that, but a leopard doesn't change its spots. Mm-hmm. So if they're a nice person who fits in well, they're always likely to be a nice person who fits in well. But you can't keep up an act for a whole year, so most people would be found out if they were a square peg in a round
hole. Yeah, absolutely. So it sounds like you're looking at cultural fit and they just blend with the team appropriately. Yeah. And so when you've been developing the model that you have, it sounds like that natural progression from FD to NHS associate to potentially private associate. How's that shifting the balance of NHS versus private work within the organisation?
The organisation has, since 2006, almost reinvented itself from scratch, because we took a long, hard look at our business model in 2006 and realised that we could not continue on in the way that we had been operating for the previous 16 or 17 years, in so much as because we were working on a fee per item basis previously, we had no restrictions other than our own lack of popularity, our own success, and our own desire to expand. But because all of a sudden we became limited as to what we could achieve, because by definition the UDA target would limit us, we had to find a way of getting growth into the business that was not dependent upon government funding and would not be restricted by an outside third party. So we realised, from our point of view, we felt the best way to achieve that was a private reinvention. So from being almost exclusively NHS, we have now spent the last 16 odd years changing ourselves into a mixed practice whereby we're split almost exactly 50-50, and our private arm has come from initially general practitioners converting and then bringing in specialist secondary care services, often encouraging people already in post to retrain to become specialists so they could stay with the group and give us value added service, as well as acquiring new skills. And we became more attractive to secondary care, private sector, better trained and qualified individuals, because we could offer them a very good referral base, because most practitioners who rely upon referrals would bite the proverbial hand off for 32 immediate on-site referrals straight away. It would take many individual practices years to build up that referral base, and we are offering it wrapped up and gift wrapped in one go.
And how do you find then the communication skills aspect of this? Because presumably there's one thing about the clinical skills, there's another thing about how effectively they build relationships with patients to be able to upsell.
So. Yes, I think every member of the audience listening to this with any years of experience will always know that the very most popular dentists are not always the best clinical dentists. Usually they're the best personalities. So as such, if you can have a rapport with a patient, and particularly if you can establish that quickly, particularly when the patient is in pain and distressed, you will probably have a raving fan for life. So the quality of the dentistry, ethically and morally, must be good for us to continue to employ that colleague. But I would never suggest that the most popular dentists are necessarily the ones who cut the best MOG cavities or fit the very best crowns. They're the people that you like and the people get on with and are good relators. So if we can have a good relator, they will always have a better conversion than the clinicians who perhaps are too focused on the work and not focused enough on the human aspect of what they do with patient interaction.
Yeah, now, I'm not sure how accurate my perception is, but it feels that at undergrad level, focuses all on the clinical skills and not the interpersonal skills and the communication skills. So you must get a variety of people coming out that are malleable, maybe, but...
Yes, that's very true, Andrew, because, I mean, if you talk to the educators, of course, they rightly say they do not have enough time to achieve everything that they would like to do. And their job is to focus on providing clinical skills, and then perhaps it becomes a case of the practice gives that value added. So if you have a colleague who is open and responsive and willing to learn and be moulded and guided, then you can do a lot with that if they just have the right basic personality. I appreciate that a leopard cannot change his spots, so sometimes you'll have an uneven fit, particularly nowadays that the FD1 candidates tend to pick the practices and not the practices picking the FD1 candidates. So sometimes their expectations are unrealistic or inappropriate. However, if you get someone who's a good fit, you can work with them, you can put them on postgraduate development courses, we have in-house training programs, and if they wish to learn and be mentored, they can gain confidence and speed over that 12-month period to prepare them for the transition into practice much more effectively.
Now, I mean, that sounds excellent because you mentioned before about litigation and complaints and things. Now, that sort of area, I think, is a huge concern for people. And we know that something like 60-70% of complaints arise from breakdowns in communication. So arming them with the communication skills is not only helpful in terms of upselling of treatment and moving into private care, but also avoiding GDC involvement and any kind of litigation. Another way that some dentists seem to be avoiding that or minimising the risk of that is going down the defensive dentistry route. Is that something that you see and that you have to actively work with, or is the culture of your organisation such that doesn't really manifest itself?
Oh no, I would not wish to mislead the audience by saying that it's not something we see or it's not something that we're aware of or have to cope with. Of course we do. It would be naive to suggest otherwise. However, I think there is an element of you have to give the individual belief in their own skill and their own talent and their ability to think on their feet and deal with the situation as it arises in front of them. Because a confident practitioner will always take a patient along with them much better than an unconfident practitioner. I appreciate that you can be too confident and you can be overreaching in what you're hoping to achieve. And obviously overselling and under-delivering is a recipe for disaster before you begin. But if you have the talent to express any reservations or concerns about the outcome of treatment while you're gaining informed consent, and then even better can over-deliver when it's actually achieved, the patient will be delighted and it's unlikely to do anything other than recommend you and certainly not complain. However, if you are tentative, if you lack the confidence, the body language, the ability to look the person in the eye, you're unlikely to have a patient who's bought into that treatment plan, no matter what they sign or say, because the retrospective they will always go back to say, well, I had reservation before it even began. So therefore, the person who is providing the treatment plan must have the knowledge, must have the confidence, and know the framework in which they can perform competently and not overperform or underdeliver.
Excellent. And looking at longer term then, so you're obviously doing sounds like a very great job at grooming people for potentially becoming good practice owners themselves some way down the line.
Yes.
So how does retention at the sort of other end of their career work?
Well, that's a very sensible question, and of course it's got a very split answer because the type of person who appeals to us by definition is someone who has something about them. And more often than not, that something is they have the desire to do it for themselves eventually. So I think that we understand that they may not stay with us forever. We would like it if that was the case. But if you have an ambitious individual, they realise that within our structure they will come to a ceiling, at which point they would then have to leave in order to have control of their own destiny. So admittedly, over the years we have lost some excellent colleagues that we would have preferred to have held on to. However, because of the cost of practice purchase, because of the expenditure involved in compliance, because of the workload that goes with that, particularly if you were buying a small practice where that burden would fall upon you exclusively, then we are fortunate that many of our best colleagues remain within our organisation because that is done for them, that burden is taken away from them. And many of them see how much effort it takes my wife and I to do it, and have no desire to replicate that at all. And then if the person was not ambitious, they might almost deselect themselves from us by default because they would know that they would not be a comfortable environment for them to stay in. So they may choose to go somewhere else, because I do appreciate that we're not right for everybody because we are so unique and so big. So if you're a shrinking violet, you may not like our organisation, but if you're a great team player and wish to grow, be mentored, have lots of colleagues for second opinions and social interaction, then we can certainly offer that.
Well, I think, I've visited hundreds, actually thousands of practices over the years that I've spent in dentistry, and I think when you describe yourself as unique, that's absolutely correct. So I really appreciate you taking the time to sort of describe your business model and your approach to us.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much.